There are grave fears for a swimmer missing from Sydney's Coogee Beach as the search for the 25-year-old man enters a second day. It follows a deadly start to the year on New South Wales beaches amid dangerous surf conditions. A 25-year-old woman believed to be a Chinese national died after being swept off rocks at Maroubra Beach. On the state's mid-north coast, a 45-year-old woman was pulled from the water at Dunbogan Beach, but could not be revived. On New Year's Eve, a man was airlifted to hospital in a serious condition after getting in trouble at Avoca Beach, while another man died after a dinghy capsized at Palm Beach. In Queensland, at Whitehaven Beach, a 35-year-old Irish man was found deceased in the water. Victoria Police say New Year's Eve celebrations were largely peaceful, praising the vast majority of revellers across the state. Acting Assistant Commissioner Tim Tully says more than 2,300 officers were deployed statewide, working alongside emergency services to manage crowds and events. Police made 18 arrests, mainly for assaults, drug offences and traffic-related incidences, while targeted operations in Melbourne CBD, St Kilda and Geelong uncovered no weapons. Authorities also responded to more than 300 fireworks-related incidents, including fires and serious injuries, prompting renewed warnings about illegal fireworks. Mr. Tully says police officers on roadside patrol detected 3 drink drivers and 2 drug drivers from more than 5,000 roadside tests.
While we don't want anyone impaired on the roads, we were pleased that the more than 5,100 roadside tests, there weren't more people over the limit or drug impaired. It is also a reminder to consider if you'll still be over the limit today. We'll be out and about drug and alcohol testing, so if you've had a big night, stay off the roads.
A 19-year-old man in Western Australia has been charged after allegedly throwing a firecracker into bushland on New Year's Eve and sparking a bushfire. The bushfire left 800 homes and businesses without power east of Perth Airport, with the fire threatening homes and property before being downgraded to a watch and act. Arson investigations charged the 19-year-old with breach of duty after allegedly throwing the firecracker into dry grass just after midnight. A spokesperson for the WA Department of Fire and Emergency Services says residents should remain on alert.
It's really important that residents are aware that we've had a very difficult start to the bushfire season, and 2026 is looking no different. So make sure that residents that live in bushfire-prone areas have a bushfire plan, they follow Emergency WA, and the residents that left and went to the evacuation centre did the right thing and followed advice of DFES.
The New South Wales Premier has ruled out lobbying the Prime Minister for a national royal commission into the Bondi terror attack, saying he will not politicise the issue. Chris Minns has committed to a New South Wales-led royal commission, despite growing calls from Jewish groups and victims' families for a broader national inquiry. The state opposition has urged Mr. Minns to seek a Commonwealth Royal Commission, arguing a state process may be limited by jurisdictional boundaries. Police are investigating after racist flyers containing white nationalist messaging were dropped into letterboxes across Newcastle, with New South Wales Premier Chris Minns promising swift action against those responsible. The flyers were distributed in Cooks Hill and surrounding suburbs and are also understood to have appeared in Sydney and Wollongong. Newcastle police say inquiries are ingoing. Speaking in Sydney, Mr. Minns says those responsible would face the full force of the law if identified.
I am aware of them, and they are an incitement to racial hatred. I mean, they're generally being distributed anonymously, but if we catch who's responsible for it, I can promise you police will throw the book at them.
Newcastle MP Tim Crankenthorpe says racism and hate speech would not be tolerated, urging anyone who received a flyer to report it to police or Crime Stoppers on 1800 333 000. New South Wales toll relief program capping charges at $60 per week has been made permanent. Drivers are now able to seek reimbursement online, which means they pay no more than $60 per week in road tolls. The program will be partially funded by the introduction of a two-way toll from late 2028 for drivers using Sydney's Harbour Bridge and Harbour Tunnel. New South Wales Transport Minister John Graham says drivers from Sydney's western suburbs are the biggest beneficiaries of the toll cap.
Today is the day that toll relief becomes permanent in the form of that $60 toll cap, which has made such a big difference to motorists. More than 700,000 claims have been issued for toll relief in the form of the $60 toll cap. More than $200 million going out, flowing out often into those western Sydney suburbs where people don't have the opportunity to jump on public transport.
A $5,000 annual limit will apply, and from January 5, drivers will be able to contact a new independent ombudsman for support with complaints about toll operators and service providers. The Bureau of Meteorology says residents in northern Queensland can expect more rain and thunderstorms as floodwaters continue to rise. The Bureau warns isolated heavy falls of 100 millimetres are possible in parts of the northern goldfields, as well as Upper Flinders, Northwest and Central West districts. 6 hourly rainfall totals between 100 and 180 millimetres are likely, with the potential of isolated falls above 220 millimetres in areas from about Townsville to Yarrabah. Minister for Industry Tim Ayres tells Sky News that the federal government will work with the state government to provide disaster relief.
What typically happens in these sort of situations is the state government leads the initial response, but working very closely with the federal government to make sure, not just in the days that the flooding happens, but in the weeks and months that follow, that we've got an effective response back in Australians, and in this case, looking after the interests of Northwest Queenslanders.
And now in sport, Matilda's captain Sam Kerr has capped off 2025 by marrying her long-term partner, American football player Christy Mewis, in a private New Year's Eve ceremony in Perth, Western Australia. The couple exchanged vows in front of about 120 guests at a residence in Swan Valley, with teammates from both Australia and US national teams among those attending. And now for today in the weather, Perth is seeing cloud clearing at 22, Broome a possible shower at 30, Darwin is seeing stormy weather at 26, Alice Springs is mostly sunny at 28. The Tiwi Islands is seeing a possible storm with chances of thunder and lightning at 25. Brisbane is possible rain at 25. And Cairns is rain with a possible storm at 26. Sydney is partly cloudy at 21. And Canberra is seeing some cloud cover at 15. Melbourne is partly cloudy at 16. Hobart is cloudy at 14. And Adelaide is sunny at 22. And that wraps up the latest in news, sport and weather. You're listening to NITV Radio. Welcome back. You're listening to NITV Radio. Later on the show, Kerry Shying gives a glimpse into her poetry. It's not just personal, it's a tool to bridge stories across communities. She notes that everyone has the right to tell their own story, and that includes voices often overlooked or underestimated. But first, up next, Hunter Paige Lockhart stars alongside Tasman Walton in a brand new SBS and NITV original series, Reckless, a darkly funny, high-stakes drama where guilt, family and dysfunction collide in a coastal town of Fremantle. Hunter joins NITV Radio's Luana Grant to talk more about the series, his character, and what audiences can expect to see when they watch Reckless.
Thanks so much to me today, and I'm really excited to talk about the new series, Reckless. Described as pure chaos, a dark comedy with deadly family secrets, how would you describe this series in your own words?
Oh, Lord. I think they've already described it pretty well, but I would call it reckless. No, Terrible joke. No, I think I would describe it as a dark comedy that really explores kind of the ups and downs of sibling rivalry, I guess. It's a show where too many mistakes happen.
And can you tell us a little bit about your character, Charlie? What drives him, and how does his relationship with June, who's played by Tasma Walton, set the tone for the story?
I think because they're such polar opposites, and I think that has to do with their upbringing as well. You know, Charlie's a character that wears his heart on his sleeve. He's a bit oblivious to the bad energy in life, I think, because you know he just wants to coax along a little bit positively, and sometimes that direction, I think, distracts him from the real problems that are swirling around him, whether that is with his baby mama or his sister or his responsibilities. I definitely think, you know, he was the mother's boy growing up, and June definitely wasn't the mother's girl. And I think that is kind of where the rivalry stems from, is the mother's attention, I think, and the different perceptions of their upbringing. And so they definitely love each other. I think Charlie loves June a bit more, but at the end of the day, I think they definitely do both love each other. Yeah, but it definitely stems from their upbringing, and June having to deal with a lot more, and Charlie kind of being protected his whole life.
And that sibling dynamic between you and Tasma's character is really central to the story. What was it like building that on-screen chemistry with Tasma?
It was fun. It's the second time or third time I've gotten to work with Tasma, so there's already a strong relationship there personally, but you know, I've got an older sister, and so I know how it is to tease your older sister or to be singled out, etc. So we kind of really just kind of straight away treated each other like we were brother and sister a little bit too much. There were moments where I was telling Tasma to kind of like ease up a bit. Yeah, it was definitely you know, a moment where, you know, we had some great rehearsals with Bec Cole, who directed it, and Cody Bedford, who wrote it, to just kind of get a clear insight of how much they do, you know, how much how much time they've spent together over the years. How much loyalty Charlie has towards June and vice versa. So we really got into the nuts and bolts of what their relationship is and where it stems from. And then the chemistry, I think, just came from me and Tasma just kind of you know, jumping in and enjoying it. Because the script, you know, it's rare when you get such a good cohesive script that has it all there for you. You know, all you really got to do is just rock up and deliver what's on the page.
And you did mention Reckless was written by the amazing Cody Bedford and directed by Bec Cole, two incredible women in film and TV. What was it like working alongside them?
Well, it was like I was working with three big sisters. You know, they all kind of, you know, they're all very different, but they all kind of treated me the same in that sense of like the younger little brother on set. But you know, it was great. You know, Beck is such a force of nature. She really is experienced and knows what she's doing, and you know, you trust her immensely, and she delivers. And Cody's kind of the same. You know, Cody was there every single day. It's rare that you get a writer on set every single day, and so it really became sort of this, you know, family that was trying to all achieve the same thing. So it was great. It was great to be a part of. I would 100% jump into the firing line for any of those women. Yeah.
And without giving too much away, there's a mix of like humor and high stakes drama. What was the most like challenging or maybe surprising part of balancing all of those different aspects as an actor?
Oh, look, I think at times it gets a bit hard because you try to question if you can do the comedy or if you can be funny. But I think a lot of that has to come down to one, your leadership, which is Bet Cole, and kind of guiding you and reining you in and making sure you're hitting the right beats. But also the writing, again, you know, like Cody really wrote something that was funny on the page. And, you know, usually when you're doing a comedy, you're always trying to ad lib or kind of add a bit more jokes to the story, but it really didn't need any of that. You know, there was a lot of moments where me especially was just telling myself it's there, it's on the page. It's within the character. The comedy is within the character. It's not so much, you know, punchlines and jokes and all those things. It's very much the characteristics and the circumstances that these characters put themselves in that is funny. And so it was really just trying to do the truth of that, like do the truth of what's actually happening rather than the truth of what's funny, because then the humor came out of that, really. Like there was a lot of moments on set where we would be losing it, cracking up and having to redo a take. And it wasn't because someone said a funny line or anything like that. It was just because of the mannerisms that the actor was playing that character as, you know? So yeah, a lot of it had to do with the writing and just the leadership, really. Yeah. But you know, it was hard. And there was a lot of moments where we said, okay, no, just follow the drama in this, because no matter how serious you are about your predicament or your situation, someone's going to find the absurdity funny of that, the absurdity of that situation funny. So yeah, we just had to lean into what was already there.
And how did filming like in Fremantle influence the energy and the authenticity of the story, and, you know, being in that environment? What was it like being able to film there?
Oh, I love it. I definitely fell in love with Fremantle and Perth, but definitely Fremantle. Look, you know, you're around the community, you're around your locations. You definitely feel a lot more immersed, you know, instead of having to travel so far away to your locations. You know, we were living in Fremantle and working in Fremantle, so you definitely kind of, you're able to observe quite a lot of the community within that area and kind of just replicate that. You know, there was a lot of moments in rehearsals where I had to get rid of my Eastern Australian accent and try and do a, you know, deeper Troy Cassar-Daly vibe for WA. So that was kind of the only thing really that was hard for me to kind of place. But other than that, I think just being immersed in Fremantle and living there really just helped create such an authentic vibe, I think.
And the series mixes crime and comedy in a really bold way. What do you hope mob and like broader audiences will take away from Reckless?
I think what I hope is to get more urban stories like this. You know, we have black characters that are living in an urban setting and doing urban things and trying to find their place in this Australian world, I guess, which I think is, you know, it's not really showcased on screen quite a lot. So I hope, you know, audiences, not so much, I don't hope that they take something from it. I hope that they just want more of that. You know, I really feel like Cody's cracked something here, and I honestly feel that hopefully this opens the gates for more kind of modern commercial takes of Indigenous stories. Because, you know, this at the end of the day, this isn't really an Indigenous story. It's just got Indigenous characters in it, and they're living their authenticity and they're living their truth as an Indigenous person living in the city.
Music. Welcome back. You're listening to NITV Radio. Up next, a compelling conversation with Luana Grant and Kerry Shying, a Wiradjuri poet with a mixed heritage, including Chinese-Australian ancestry, shares how poetry serves as a tool for emotional expression and cultural connection. Despite living with a degenerative disease, Kerry explains how poetry helped her regain her voice and connect with both her Indigenous roots and broader communities. Have a listen to this.
Yira Damarung, hello and welcome to Speak My Language Disability, as we share stories of First Nations peoples who are engaging in their passions while also living with a disability. Throughout this series, you will hear inspiring stories from leaders and advocates within the community who have successfully pursued their dreams in their chosen fields. In this episode, I chat with Kerry Shying, a poet of Chinese and Wiradjuri heritage. Kerry is based in Newcastle and runs bi-monthly online disability peer writing workshops to support and empower others and create an inclusive community space both on and offline.
Thank you so much, Kerry, for joining us on Speak My Language, and I'm really excited to chat with you today.
I'm excited to be here.
Firstly, can you please introduce yourself, who you are, what you do, where you're from, and who's your mob?
Well, I'm Kerry Shying, and I live in Mullumbimba, which is Newcastle. I'm from Sydney originally. My mob is Wiradjuri. I'm a mixed person. So I also come from a Chinese-Australian family, one of the oldest in the country, in fact, the oldest. So I have lots of relations everywhere. My father's people are from Wiradjuri people, and they're up from Dubbo. My mother's people are from Canamble.
Oh, amazing. So, well, I'm a Wiradjuri woman as well.
Yeah, I kind of thought you were, actually.
Yeah. So it's really lovely to chat to another Wiradjuri woman, and I'm really, really happy to be chatting with you. What role does poetry play in your life?
Poetry is my whole life. It's not my whole life. I have dogs and gardening and other people. I think community is my whole life. I wasn't raised to be an individual, and I really think most of us weren't. We were really raised to be of service and to be part of very large families. You know, I think sometimes I go driving with friends and I say, oh, I've got a cousin lives here. Oh, my cousin's from here. And I can see their faces sometimes going, oh, she's got a lot of cousins. So I think everyone's really familiar with that wonderful sense of connection and how much we want to spread it, and how sometimes when you're disabled you kind of lose that if you can't get out, and so poetry is a great way to express your emotions and to transmit them to other people. And so sometimes people think it's a highbrow thing, but it's not. You know, the people who read and write the most poetry are people who are in prison. And I think people always forget that rap came from poetry, drill music comes from poetry. You know, poetry is for everyone. So, and people's stories are their own stories. Nobody needs someone else to tell their story. You know, it comes from your heart. You know, country music's poetry. Poetry's everywhere. I love poetry.
And how does poetry connect you to culture? And do you use any Indigenous language within your poetry writing?
I do. Not a lot. At the moment, I do some things that I call decolonizing. I talk a bit about, particularly about assimilation and people's attitudes. There's one that I have, I sometimes use words that I never thought were Indigenous words growing up, were Wiradjuri words, or Chinese words. You know, they're just words that you always thought of. And so I think sometimes language becomes so embedded in you that it doesn't occur to you that it is language. I generally go through the Parkes Wiradjuri language group to, and the oldest member of my family, who is an elder, Aunty Lola, I go through her to check that I'm using language in the right way, because I think it's really important to remember that language belongs to everybody, and also that sometimes when you're telling stories and family stories, that they're family stories and they belong to everyone. My nana, when we travelled, would say, "Who are your people? Where's your country? Who's your people?" And that's something I always remember as a child. Her first greeting to someone was, "Where's your country? Who's your people?" It's something that, living with disability, it's important to know who your people are. Literature, and especially literature from your own people, can help you do that.
And who influenced you or inspired you to become a poet?
I kind of started writing poetry because I became much sicker. I have a degenerative disease and I couldn't write longer. I used to write short stories. I really love Gail Kennedy. People that just write, like, write from their guts, you know. In terms of poetry, there's also Dorothy Hewitt, short stories. But I was reading the other day Ant-Man and Fleabag, which is, it's just the most fabulous book. Gail wrote the, she's a graphic, Aboriginal graphic novelist as well. You know, she did all the old Streetwise comics. You know, Gail lives with disability. So it's one of those things where sometimes, even though you have disability, it gives you the opportunity to focus in on what you want to do. And you can look at, you know, we're all used to people telling us what the deficits are. So sometimes it's really good to sort of turn around and say, well, what can I do with this? You know, how can I make it work for me? And really, talking about your story, it's low cost and it's got a high impact. People in poetry can speak in their own voice. You don't have to learn all the forms that are out there to be a good poet. You can write in your own way, and there's certainly people who will publish that.
And how have you found connections with other poets and writers living with disability?
It's the best. We're actually just putting out a book coming out later in the year called Raging Grace, which is about, we did collaborative poems, which is just means more than one person wrote each poem, which was a big Zoom effort every Sunday where we all got together and talked all about. It was like a big yarn-up, basically. And it was me, Andy Jackson, Esther Ottaway, Jasper Peach, a whole lot of other poets who with disability. And a lot of people can't get out because of COVID nowadays. I'm immune suppressed, so I have to wear a mask. And we got together and people often were in their beds or whatever, but we made sure that everyone had their voice, and then people formed groups and wrote back and forth to each other, like sometimes call and response. And we all just wrote. And the poems that came out of it and the way we talked about disability was really interesting. There was joy, there was anger, there was all those things, you know. And luckily we were able to find a publisher and do it all on our own terms, and that's coming out in October, and it's going to be really good to put that voice out there. I encourage people to remember too, if you're disabled, you don't have to write about your disability. You can write about whatever you like. It still makes you a disabled writer, but you don't have to write you know, you don't have to stay in your lane.
Can you tell me about your writing workshops and what made you start them, and what was the purpose of starting that up?
The purpose of it was a lot of people with disability live, I mean, the thing that comes with disability is poverty. One of the things that happens is for a lot of people, you know, you're put into poverty compared to what you were before. And also, you know, for a lot of people too, they've been diagnosed with something that means they might have a lot of other needs in terms of special diet or, you know, prescriptions and so forth. And so maybe they want to go to a workshop or go somewhere with other writers. So it became really, and then workshops for writers can cost, you know, at least between $40 and sometimes up to $120. And it's really important that people with disability have access, to my mind, have access to quality mentors and other writers. There's nothing like sitting in a room with other writers and working with them, and, you know, it's like everything. It's like a yarn up. You just, you know, you gain experience. Someone might say, oh, you could do it this way. It's the best kind of experience you can have. You can swap books. I think of it as mutual aid. We don't need the permission always, the funding. It's good to have support from writers' centres. But making people include you can start with having mutual aid. So we decided, myself and another friend, Andrew Spannenberg, decided we would start the group. And we wanted people of all ages, all disabilities, and also all kinds of writers to be able to join us regardless, so, and for free. So it's always been a free group. We've been able to have guest writers, people donate books, and then we've been able to also expand that to mentoring, especially out in the Central West. You know, we've all got something to give, and it's good for you to give. It brings joy into your life, and it's also an experience that helps you feel more competent and you learn from it. A lot of people in our group have had experiences with the prison system and other things, and these are experiences they bring to the group. Lynn Reeves is running it. She came to us originally where she just had no experience writing. She's been published internationally now, and she's very passionate about writing. And when I wanted to move more into mentoring in the Central West and so forth, she then stepped up and said she would run the bi-weekly groups online. And this has been a really great step for her. So we're really proud of it. And that's the great thing when you do groups like this, people flower, you know.
And I was going to ask you, do you see an impact, like what impact do you see on others who are involved in the workshops?
Part of what makes us keep going is having a challenge and feeling like we have something meaningful to do. And feeling worthwhile. And often people with disability get a lot of stick, and of course mob gets a lot of stick as well. And so if people are continually kind of treating you as though you're sucking up the resources of everybody, when you're there and you're learning new skills and you're starting to, say, run a group, or you're the one who's there for somebody else, it really I think it just really helps your self-esteem, you know. We write every time we meet. In the end, people read out what they've written, and you're just amazed that everyone's written about the same thing, but it's all different, you know. And there's something really joyful in that. And I think that's what comes out of it is that self-esteem, the confidence, and people improving as they realise they can edit themselves. It creates a continuation of knowing that you can do some things, because it's really easy to fall into a place of thinking, I can't do this, I can't do that. And so it's very joyful to come together with people and find some things, even if it's one line.
And what would you say to other people wanting to take initiative to start something of their own?
Look, get friends together. Start off, we have a group here. Also, you know, you can have friendship groups. Bring the things into your life remotely if you can. You know, think a little bit outside the box and try and make people include you.
Mm. And are there services that have empowered you?
To be honest, a lot of libraries now have social, you know, kind of social action, or what's sometimes called placemaking. A lot of Aboriginal corporations also have some pretty good events. Sometimes it's enough just to have a venue to sit down at.
I'll just ask you the final question. Do you have any suggestions for how people living with disability can access services with confidence?
Just remember, you're a person and you have a right to live on this earth.
And that was Kerry Shying yarning to me on Speak My Language. Speak My Language Disability is an initiative funded by the Commonwealth Department of Social Services. It is led by the Ethnic Communities Council of New South Wales and proudly delivered in partnership with SBS. For more episodes of Speak My Language, follow the podcast on the SBS Audio app, Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.